Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined this week by my good friend David Moser, academic director of the CET program here in Beijing. And how are you on this wintry morning in Beijing?
Yes, blustery. Is that the word?
Drizzly.
Drizzly, blustery, yes. But I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah. So, David, got a question for you. So, when you finished college, back whenever that was, what was the it city or country for Americans of your generation to head to, you know, to kind of rusticate for a couple of years, get that experience of living abroad?
That's interesting. I don't know. It seems like at that time, China was not yet on the radar.
Definitely not.
On the radar. But in terms of overseas visiting?
Yeah, overseas. Right. I guess your generation was still going to Canada.
Right. We were escaping things. Right. Yeah, right, exactly.
I guess for me, I was maybe tail end of Japan. The Japan era was maybe coming to an end, and for people a couple of years younger than me, it was definitely Prague. I mean, Prague was like where you went. Everyone went to Prague. They wrote for the Prague Post. And they met Václav Havel, and they read a lot of Kundera novels. That was the early 90s. But at some point, maybe it was as late as the Olympics, I feel like China and specifically Beijing and Shanghai became sort of the it destinations for a lot of people. And maybe it's, I don't know. I mean, it seems like there are an awful lot of people I know who now they finish college and they decide, I'm going to spend a year in China. I'm going to spend a couple of years in China. I guess it would be horrifically immodest to suggest that it might have, you know, the potential to be a Paris of the 20s, right? I mean, I've heard people, you know, make that suggestion, but, you know, where's our fucking Gertrude Stein? Where's our Hemingway? Where's our Fitzgerald? You know, where's our John Dos Passos? What's up with that? I mean, we somehow have not...
Well, you know, arguably, in terms of art, the art world, in terms of money, Beijing is certainly, in Shanghai, becoming art capitals of the world, if not the art capital. As far as where are the Picassos, in terms of expats who come there and make that their home.
We're banning that word. We're not using that word.
the type of person formerly known as expat.
We're calling them migrants now. Migrants.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe those people are here, Kaiser, and we just don't know them yet because we're of this generation, and within 20 years, the books will come out, and the Gertrude Steins and the James Joyces will be there, and you just don't know it. Maybe some of them are in our midst right now.
Well, we do have Pete Hessler. Peter Hessler, but he wasn't writing, of course. I mean, he doesn't live here anymore. He lives in Cairo. But he wasn't writing fiction either. He was writing nonfiction.
It doesn't matter.
Well, still, I mean, I'd love to see some of the fiction writers. But, you know, I think there is one little group of individuals here who are making a splendidly good effort to encourage and to collect and to offer a platform for the publication of writers of both fiction and nonfiction, and that, of course, is The Ant Hill. And in time for the holiday season, there's a new anthology or an antology of English writings by people living here in Beijing, most of them, I guess foreigners, some of them also Chinese. Indeed, actually, David, both you and me have little things in there, right? Mm-hmm. The volume is called While We're Here, China Stories from a Writer's Colony, and it was lovingly assembled and edited by the two gentlemen joining us here in the pop-up studio to talk about it. So we have Alec Ash and Tom Pelham. So Alec, of course, hello, Alec.
Hello, Kaiser. Thanks for having me on the show.
You, of course, are the founder and the queen ant of the ant hill. Is that a fair?
That's my preferred term weekends, at least.
Right. And this writers' collective, the online content of which you drew all this anthology from, and then of course Tom Pelham, who is the fiction editor of the ant hill. So welcome, guys. Good to have you both here. When does the book come out?
The book is launched in the Beijing Bookworm on Friday, the 27th of November, which I think will be before this podcast goes out.
And yeah, it'll unfortunately, be, it will be. Right.
It'll be up on Amazon, should be about a month after that, hopefully in time for that Christmas stocking.
Ah, terrific, terrific. So actually, this anthology contains pieces by many Seneca guests who have joined us here before, including Anthony Tao and Sasha Mtashek. Who else? Carl Seltzer and
Robert Foyle Hunwick
and Laszlo Montgomery, Jeremiah Jenny. Who else?
Carl Seltzer.
Yes, of the Great Leap. So that's quite a number. So
Robert Foyle Hunwick, right?
Yeah, we mentioned him. I was out drinking with him last night. In fact,
RFH, I believe it's
RFH, Mr. RFH. So let's start with, before we get deeply into the anthology itself, let's talk about the anthill. And the origins of that idea and what inspired you to do this?
Sure. Well, I set up the Anthill in autumn of 2012, which is when I got back to Beijing after a couple of years in London. I'd previously done 2 years of hard time in Wudako learning Chinese from 2008 to 2010. And I set it up as I was coming back to Beijing to write full time. And I set it up as a bit of a sandbox for my own writing to try and find some sort of voice for myself while still getting feedback. And at the same time, I opened it up and I wanted to become an open house for anyone in China who had a story to tell. Originally nonfiction, which is the genre I work in. And then pretty soon after, Tom joined as co-editor and we expanded it to fiction. I guess the spirit in which I set it up is I was slightly fed up with news about China and I was slightly fed up with blogs which were echoing the news about China, and I thought you would read the same thing 20 times. I wanted to find and to publish the stories which no one else could tell, because it's your neighbor or it's you and your story in China. And I find that that kind of narrative style storytelling just personally engages me more, and I think it's a way to get under the skin of China in, I think, a more meaningful way if it's done well.
Presumably, there are some criterion that you apply, though, right? You don't just let any old schmuck contribute a piece of nonfiction writing and publish.
I did in the beginning. I think we're getting more selective now. I have a pretty laissez-faire attitude to it in general. I think that most stories are interesting. There are some which we avoid if we feel that it falls into this wacky China trap, which is the biggest trap for certainly foreigners writing about China, sort of, I came to China and this wacky thing is happening. And that's just not interesting on its own merits. You've got to do something more than that.
Maybe, Tom, we can talk about the wacky trap a bit. I mean, it happens in the fiction as well. And there are a number of traps, right, David, I think, in writing about China. Maybe let's tick some of them off. We've talked about that, though. You know, hey, you wouldn't believe the weird shit that happened to me while I was here in China. I think for me, I guess my big pet peeve is it's so rare that I encounter believable Chinese characters written in. They don't have that authenticity to me. It's difficult, of course, to ever step into anyone else's mind and to sort of plumb the depths and make them believable. But it seems particularly to plague writing on China. I mean, I dare say even some of the writing in this anthology actually maybe falls a little bit short of what I would have hoped. What are some of the other pitfalls that you try to
I don't know about a genre, but one thing that really pisses me off is people who misrepresent the depth of their own understanding at the time in the incident that they're describing, as if they understood everything everyone was saying. They had a very good grasp of the situation. I've seen so many accounts of 1989. Where they say, and then a guy came up to me and said, "Have you seen this?" And I got in a car and I went over here. And they seem very clear. There's never any misunderstandings. There's never any,
The truth is more like, oh, wait, what was that?
Yeah.
What did you say?
I mean, if the person were to tell the truth.
Do you speak English?
Yeah, right. Some guy came up to me and said a whole bunch of things. And he said, "Do you want to do that?" And I just said, yes. I had no idea what I was doing. And I got in this Jeep and I ended up someplace I didn't even.
Right.
They never admit that it's completely chaotic. Even nowadays, I mean, this happens to me all the time, but people pretend that their Chinese is so good and they have these deep conversations with two people.
I think that's also missing some of the most interesting material sometimes is how a foreigner who maybe doesn't have great Chinese engages with this country.
Yeah.
Like, that's rich material for writing as well. You don't need to pretend that you know it all to write something engaging.
I've seen the whole process of language acquisition depicted in fiction and in nonfiction a few times, I think very cleverly in nonfiction. Peter Hessler, again, I mean, I think we've actually talked about it on this show before, in Rivertown, how he jogs past the sign and then, you know, sort of like letters on a Wheel of Fortune board, mm-hmm. they sort of
yes.
start
right.
turn up more and more, you know, yeah. more and more of the characters become recognizable to him.
At this point, perhaps we can mention that both Tom and I are huge Peter Hessler fanboys, sure. as are a lot of people of our generation.
Me too.
And most of the people in this book, there are a few sort of grizzled China hands such as yourself, but a lot of them are people sort of in their 20s, early 30s, like Tom and I, to whom sort of Peter Hessler was a role model. Tom and I even made a little pilgrimage. We rented a car and drove up to, was it Sanshai, his village up in the hills. And Tom, you came here having read Rivertown, right?
Sure, yeah. So I arrived in 2005 having read Rivertown my last semester of college. Kind of got the bug and decided to show up. But yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point about, you know, because I think I've heard one criticism of Rivertown, for example, is saying, you know, for people who have spent time in China, you know, he's describing things that we've all experienced. You know, he's describing the language learning process, like you were mentioning, Kaiser, or he's describing, you know, teaching English and things like that. And to me, what really kind of separates his type of writing from a lot of, you know, for example, submissions we would get to the Anthill is not so much the material itself. You know, it can be well-trodden ground in terms of learning the language, in terms of having a language partner or teaching English. But, you know, the treatment of it and the insight that you're able to offer, those kind of things. I mean, that's what we kind of look for when it comes to the Anthill and what we were looking for with this anthology. So, I mean, there's certainly, you know, pieces in the anthology that are about things, are about experiences that are, you know, common that a lot of people had. But the thing that's special and kind of fresh about it is the treatment of it, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that, you know, it's easy when you have great material that you can just kind of go, you know, be straight ahead, describe it in a straight ahead nonfiction way, or even give it fictional treatment. But, you know, we think that, you know, with this anthology and with the stuff that we've done with the Anthill, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of stuff experiences you might, you know, recognize as someone who spent time in China, and then stuff that's just really, you know, quite different as well.
Right. Actually, I think that the test of a writer is your ability to write a rather banal kind of, you know, quotidian experience and do it in a way where the prose really carries it. And, you know, you have terrific economy in your...
Sure.
In your...
Getting to the Anthill and also this collection, were you, Alec, or either one, Tom, trying to sort of put something in a gap that I didn't realize was there until I sort of saw what you were doing, which is there's a lot of accounts in, obviously, in the news media from news reports, from books, from scholarly books, and from a lot of Chinese people, firsthand accounts of books of different historical issues, Cultural Revolution, whatever it might be, you know. But then you have what we who live here have, which is constant sort of Lao Wai analysis, rehashing, you know, translating onto our own terms. But there isn't a lot of literature out there, high quality books and things out there, other than the rare Peter Hessler type of things, where foreigners are actually writing about these same things from their vantage point in a serious and informed way, or even sometimes just a rather confusing way. Is that something you were attempting to do with this anthology?
Sure. Well, I definitely think that there's an abundance of huge journalistic talent in Beijing, particularly really the cream of the crop. My personal preference is for personal narratives, and it could be your own story, or it could be the personal story of someone else who you've really gotten to know and gotten under their skin. And that's the kind of writing I like, and that's the kind of writing I like to publish. Picking up on your question of a gap to fill, I think that there's a lot of focus when people talk about this and talk about Hessler about white guys coming to China.
Mm-hmm.
What I personally think is much richer terrain for writing, much richer subject matter in many ways, is ethnic Chinese who were perhaps born overseas, whether they're Chinese-born foreigners, foreign-born Chinese. but they've got good stories. There's one piece in the collection by Courtney Han, who was born in Beijing and then moved abroad, I think, to America when she was 5 and moved all over. And now she's coming back as an adult in her 20s. She spent a couple of years in Mozambique, and now she comes back to Beijing And she goes to her dad's Laojia, her, you know, her ancestral home, with her cousins. And it's a sort of road trip story. And it's really about identity. It's called Roots and Leaves, and it's about recovering that sense of heritage. And I'm perpetually fascinated by the stories of someone who was born in China but then moved off.
The whole Luoye Guigen.
Yeah, Luoye Guigen, yeah.
One of the interesting, I mean, the title itself is While We're Here, which suggests, of course, the kind of ephemeral nature of the time that foreigners tend to spend in China. Do these sojourners in Tokyo or in Berlin or in Prague or Paris, is there an analogous body of literature like this? I mean, do they do the same sort of thing? Are you aware? But what is it about? Because, you know, this is not the first collection now of sort of writings by sojourners living in China. And the other one is, what was Unsavory Characters? Is that the one that I'm thinking of?
Elements, I think.
Elements, Unsavory Elements. Elements. Also published by Grammar and Shaw.
And there's also one of women, foreigner, writing about China called How to Dress to Buy Dragon Fruit, edited by Shannon Young down in Hong Kong.
Okay, no, I've not read that one. What is it about the experience here? I mean, is it just the extreme otherness of it? Is it this, that, you know, there's always the fish out of water element? And
I don't think it's necessarily always a fish out of water. I mean, there's just great stories around. I mean, it's a very dynamic place. So whether you're giving it, you know, nonfiction or fictional treatment, I mean, it's just a really kind of ripe place for stories. In the foreword to the book, Alec wrote that, you know, that a lot of the stories that are included in this collection or in the Anthill, you know, would kind of be the type of stories that you would, you know, lose at the bottom of a cocktail glass, I think, or something, as you mentioned. You know, like the idea that, you know, we have these stories, they're kind of rumbling around, and this is just kind of a platform for telling these stories. So, you know, I don't think that it's necessarily that they're all not coming from one particular voice or one conceit of like a fish out of water, or you know, like, we certainly wanted to stay away from kind of the wacky China stories like Alec was mentioning. But yeah, it's a I think there's something about the place in this point in time that kind of lends itself to kind of interesting stories. And also it's we're at this interesting point in history where, you know, people are kind of feel empowered to tell their stories. So they have tools, they have, you know, blogs and websites and stuff. Right. Whereas, you know, before you would maybe, you know, be hanging out somewhere and somebody would tell you a funny story or an interesting or insightful story. And now we kind of have a place to collect them in a way. So I think it's kind of a confluence of all those things that makes it, you know, that makes it good, a good place for material.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. I have an 18-year-old daughter who spends a lot of her time in the Sanlitun area and comes home and tells me stories, you know, of things that happen. And I tell her, you know, pay attention to this because getting back to the, you know, when will China be, Beijing be the Paris of the 21st century. I mean, I say pay attention to these stories and things, because I really believe these will be the subject matter and the place settings for lots of novels, short stories and things.
Yeah, I definitely. Then,
because quite right, it's someplace like that in Beijing is an interesting mix. It's at China at a particular time, a rising China, influx of a very multicultural foreign environment, and just a lot of that mix right there is a mix of lots of stories.
What's taking us so damn long, though? I mean, why haven't we seen this happen? I mean, Paris only had, you know, a decade or more. I mean, it's only after 1918.
Well, for all we know, it's happening. For all we know, somewhere between the Third and Fourth Ring Road, there's some semi-alcoholic English teacher who's writing the China equivalent of
maybe
The Sun
Also
Rises.
We're not drinking enough? I mean, that certainly can't be
the
case.
I think that's the problem.
I think we're in a crowded informational universe these days. So
that's what
it is. There's too damn much stuff out there.
That's what it is. That's really what it is. There's just too. I mean, it's because of these same wonderful democratizing properties of the internet that we're also just losing too much. There's a difficult sort of to manage signal-to-noise ratio. And there's just so much dreadful writing. There's so much dreadful blogging. There's so many of those retold tales. And then, you know, and there's so many of the embarrassing genres that have emerged, like the whole sexpat genre. You know, you had your Beijing Bounder, and then more recently, Alec, you actually wrote a scathing review of some guy, right?
Right.
Tell us about this. That was funny. I remember that he did this sort of anonymous-like response.
Yeah.
Tell that story.
Yeah. This is actually how I first got in contact with the publisher of the book, Graham Earnshaw, in the process of writing that book, because he was a sort of pseudonymous character in it. I wrote a hatchet job review of this sexbat memoir called Shanghai Cocktails. That's C-O-C-K-T-A-L-E-S.
Oh, how clever.
By Tom Olden, not his real name, who was in Shanghai for a decade or something. And his parting gift before he left was this sort of tale of his exploits. And I did a bit of a hatchet job on it. And then I got to hand it to the guy. His response was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, it was funny.
He posted a video where he is in front of a camera with his face concealed by a T-shirt, I think a T-shirt of the book, and his voice is distorted in this ISIS sort of jigsaw style. You know, greetings, Beijing Cream. Greetings, Alec Ash.
Yeah.
And in the background, there's this Chinese lady in a bra chopping a carrot very, very slowly and very badly. And he made, I suppose, some legitimate points, is that he felt that his experiences as a
truer
sexual conquistador were interesting. My objection to this genre of writing, my chief objection, isn't that it's so much that it's sexist and has zero attempt to understand Chinese women as individuals. It's that it's boring. You know, unless you're shagging Gourmet May, I don't think anyone really gives a crap. You know, maybe the best...
high bar.
You know, maybe you're the best writer in the world and you can write something fascinating, but, you know, the Literary Review's Bad Sex in Fiction Award exists for a reason, because it's very difficult to write about well. And I just think for a better topics, and it just doesn't make the cut. It's not interesting enough.
Mm-hmm. Tom, talk about fiction that's come out of China in the last decade or so. I mean, I think we're familiar with some Susan Barker's book.
Incantations
is the sequel, we hope. Yeah. If Susan is listening.
You know, there haven't been that many novels that have, you know, there's Rock Paper Tiger. A few other titles that are set in China or have Chinese, you know, prominent Chinese characters that are written in, originally in English. What's up with this? What's preventing this as, you know, as a setting for stories? I mean, it seems like, my God, you know, with the pace of change, what it is, just the huge human ethical moral crises that kind of underpin life here. How is this not more fertile soil for fiction writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I don't have a really clear answer. I don't think that it's necessarily, you know, if we're looking at Paris in the 20s, for example, I don't think that we can necessarily say, okay, well, you know, they got their great novel, you know, 10 years down the road, and so it's not going to be on the same kind of like timeline, I think, for all the technology related reasons that we mentioned before. I do think it's great, fertile, fertile ground for a novel setting. I liked Susan Barker's the Incarnations. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting kind of form, and I thought that it did a good job of kind of marrying the past and the present, you know, with all the historical research that she had done. I'm waiting I'm definitely kind of on the horizon, thinking of you know, when the great big realistic novel set in China could be, and what it might be a part of. I'm working on something myself, which
me too,
is
me
a
too.
Bit. Yeah, I mean, I think actually I remember in one of your old columns, Kaiser, you said something about, you know, like every expat has a 50 page of a novel that is better left abandoned.
A screenplay or a novel.
A screenplay or a novel, right. So I mean, I think that it's I think that there could be things out there that people are working on, but I totally agree. I think it's a great, especially a place like Beijing, is a really interesting place. And I don't have an answer of why we don't have it. I think that there's you know, there's some good collections of short fiction out there. You know, some of the stuff that we publish on the Anthill as well. So I think that, you know, in kind of shorter form, short story form or flash fiction form, I think people are giving China its due in fiction. It's also, you know, hard to write a novel. You know, it's really long. Nobody reads books the way they used to, blah, blah, blah. I think it's also this kind of compression of attention, and it's such a fast moving place. You know, you work on a 10-year novel and it's like, okay, well, you know, the whole place is completely different too. I mean, it's a little bit, it's kind of a moving target.
Right.
And I also think that, you know, some of the best writers, in China now are journalists. And I think that, you know, there's so much to cover and there's so much to pay attention to, it's hard to make time for creative writing as well, too. So, I mean, I think that, I don't know. I don't have a kind of a silver bullet answer.
Well, but I have three observations anyway. One is I always thought about this myself, and whenever I thought of writing short stories about China, I thought, but what's really happening is so much more interesting than anything I could concoct in my head, is one thing.
Sure.
And another thing I think that maybe is intimidating, not only the time factor you're talking about, where China changes so fast, by the time you finish your novel, the place you set it in doesn't exist, right?
Right.
But the other thing is just simply that China's a very complex place. You may think, you know, I want to write a novel set here or, you know, having to do with my experiences, but you realize that it's not your culture. It's very hard to do that. You could only write it from a viewpoint of a foreigner.
Right, and then what do you do? Are you the hapless kind of dopey guy trying to figure it out? Are you the earnest and tolerant, good-natured
reason has to do with more market considerations. Kaiser, you know, wrote some brilliant stuff for the Beijinger, you know, the end notes, you know, for the issues that are wonderful, and they're very, they're just a dictionary of all the different kinds of things that happen to foreigners in Beijing and ways of looking at it. But the problem is, most of the audience for that is people who live in Beijing, foreigners who live in Beijing. It doesn't.
It's only intended for those.
Exactly. You know, so references to Richard Clayderman is not going to get yucks, you know, in America.
I just bust a gut.
So, I mean, all these things. So even if you do write something that is, you know, set here and just is redolent of the atmosphere here, most of it's going to be lost on the foreign readers who are just going to get a vague sense of the exoticism of it. So all those things together make it very imposing to even think of writing significant fiction about this.
I mean, I don't think that the great China novel is necessarily going to look like what we consider the great expat novels and in other places before. I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be capture the entire zeitgeist of the whole country. I mean, China's a way bigger beast, I think, than Paris was in the 1920s, right? At least in that small kind of expat
retinue.
Or even
America in Lolita in Nabokov's world, where he could write about small town America in such an amazing way. Yeah. I think he couldn't do that now.
Yeah.
People are trying. There's one novel which was, I think, published very recently, which is called Up to the Mountains and Down to the Countryside.
Yeah, I have a copy of that.
Quincy Carroll, that's got to be a nom de guerre, right?
No, it's actually called Quincy Carroll. I know his sister.
So it's about, have you read it? It's about two American teachers out in the boondocks.
Right. I've started it a couple of times. I just have not had time to, the publishers asked me to read it and the authors contacted me as well. And I will at some point get along, get to it. I've got a long list as everybody does, but
I'll definitely double down on what David said in that you don't need to invent, anything that you invent in China is going to be less interesting than what you can find just by going out onto the street and tell those real stories. I personally think that where fiction can come into play is how a foreigner interacts and engages, and those sort of questions of identity. I think that's the Sun Also Rises waiting to be written.
The interesting test is very difficult. I mean, so many people conflate interesting with simply weird. Exotic. Laughable, those dopey Chinese, they're weird ways.
This is why we write stories, this is why we humanize, because people who don't understand a subject matter, you have to start from somewhere. Often that place you start from is a stereotype, an idea of China as bad or political or China as wacky. But you can also start from human beings. That's something that everyone can relate to. And that's definitely the philosophy of the Anthill and the mm-hmm. pieces in this collection.
So why don't each of you talk about some of the pieces that you that are in the anthology that you particularly liked and what it is that you liked about it. And why don't we start with you, Tom, and some sure. of the fiction pieces that you...
Yeah, okay. So, you know, one piece that I wanted to talk about that's quite good is a short story called Dumplings in the collection. It's written by a writer, Michael Salmon. And the conceit is kind of two foreigners, one who has been in China for 6 or 7 years, speaks the language, knows the place, and his cousin who's visiting him, who has, you know, I think lived in China for a few months. And it's a really interesting dynamic. They go out to eat at a dumplings restaurant. The grizzled expat, whose name is Charlie in the story, is kind of very self-conscious about being seen, engaging with China. So they go to this restaurant and they sit down. His cousin brings out a Chinese chessboard, and you know, Charlie, the older expat, is like, no, I don't want to be seen playing. What would the Chinese people think if they saw us playing Chinese like in the dumplings restaurant? Like, kind of meta, like very self-aware of this. The story kind of proceeds on that way. There's this tension between the two characters, between you know, someone who's kind of fresh off the boat, more wild-eyed, just with no tools to really appreciate, engage with China, but with that impulse to do it. Mm-hmm. Whereas you have his counterpart, someone who has the language, has the tools, but just is a little living too much in his head, doesn't really right. appreciate the place. And then there's a crisis in the story and a kind of denouement.
Those are two types I've encountered.
Yes. And I think, I mean, it's not written as a parable, but I think it is kind of, among kind of expat types, I think that we've all seen, I think it's an interesting kind of interplay between the two of them that I really enjoyed reading.
I skipped that one. I need to go back and read that. That sounds like a really good one.
Yeah.
That sounds terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
It speaks to some of the themes in the book as well. I mean, we called it While We're Here, speaking to that transience, both of foreigners who feel like they're, you know, maybe not going to live here for their whole life, maybe passing through, and also to the transience of China, which changes all around us as we remain static. And, you know, some foreigners get that 7-year itch if they come out of college, as Tom and I did.
Yeah.
One more from you.
Sure.
Another fiction piece. That
yeah. So another one that is great is a piece called Love Anywhere. The writer is Hannah Lincoln, and it's also a short story. In this one, she's actually describing two Chinese kind of university classmates who just finished school. And one of them is kind of an aspiring rock star and decides that he's going to come down from Dongbei to follow his dream to be a rock star. And he's kind of followed by his friend, who's kind of a more introverted, kind of a gopher kind of character. They come to Beijing, and it's a really interesting kind of, without giving too much away, as they're finding their fortunes, there's kind of an unrequited love kind of angle between between the friends. And so you end up with this very, very poignant kind of situation toward the end of the story, in which, you know, the rock star character, who has never like even thought of his friend in this way, is kind of confronted with the fact that his university friend had been kind of pining after him for so long, and had followed him to China and had opened a bar so his, you know, his rock star friend could actually play.
Follow him to Beijing. Right?
Follow him to Beijing, that's right, yeah. And it's really touching.
That must be very, very difficult to do. I mean, I know Hannah. She's very smart. She's a very good writer. But this, I mean, writing two Chinese characters, writing as a female about a homoerotic
right.
relationship.
Yeah.
Well, that's ambitious.
It is ambitious, and
but
I think
your endorsement suggests he pulls it off pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. It's very in my, you know, we all have kind of different reading tastes. My editing tastes tend to be more toward, you know, stories that leave a lot kind of untold, that are very delicate about it. So, you know, to be honest, I read the story a number of times without even kind of realizing there was this kind of element to it. And so, you know, I think that the best type of fiction, at least by my lights, is the type that, you know, really kind of indicates towards something, but maybe doesn't pull you right over
the
finish line with it.
And it's not right.
I think that's right. So, I mean, you know, we could argue forever, you know, can a foreigner write of a Chinese character in a truly, truly engaging way? You know, that's one of the joys of fiction, is to play with language, to play with voice, and to play with all these other things, and to experiment and to try different voices on. And I think that, you know, I definitely encourage foreign writers to write from a Chinese perspective, because I think, why not? Right. I don't think it necessarily we need to bind ourselves to this pseudo-autobiographical kind of like fiction writing about, you know, what we did and what our experiences was. I much more appreciate a good attempt, even if it maybe falls short of verisimilitude than anything else.
Well put. Yeah. Very good. Let's turn now to the nonfiction stuff. And Alec, why don't you make a couple of recommendations of pieces people should really...
Sure. I think there's a lot of great stuff in there. As you said, Kaiser, any anthology is going to be hit and miss. There'll be some stories that you love, some stories that you hate. I think there's a few sort of really weighty, fascinating pieces in there. One is by David, about 25 years.
That was a great piece. I mean, I don't want to blow smoke up your ass, but that was just...
It's about Chinese jazz. Right. It's about 25 years in Chinese jazz and sort of weflung into this jam in the early 90s, I believe. And David looks across and there's Cui Jian playing the trumpet. That's one. RFH has another one, great one, on one of Beijing's last...
Down in Fengtai.
Shuangxingtang, right? Also the setting of that great film, Xi Zao.
That film is called... It's by Zhang Yang, who's one of the great...
Shower.
Directors, fifth generation directors.
I want to talk about one by Sasha Matushak, who has been on this podcast. He lived in Chengdu for a while, and he wrote this story from a village on the outskirts, one of these kind of Nongxiala villages, quite a few years back. It's called Flower Town. And he talks about trying to be part of that village and sort of falling short in many ways. Like he's not immediately welcomed as part of the community, and I think some of the people there see him as a bit of a sort of down and out foreigner who doesn't really have a job. And then the Oet earthquake strikes, and suddenly there's this sense of solidarity and camaraderie, and everyone pulls together to get through this. And then later the village itself is torn down by developers. And it just it hits a lot of notes for me about Lawai local relations. Mm. I think it's a story which it's well told. Sasha does a great job with it. It's quite long, I think 6,000 words, but it's a good read. I like that one.
And that is a thread that goes through much of this book and much of our lives, I'm sure. It's, you know, this eternal question of can we ever actually belong here?
Yes, that's really good. Alec, your piece actually is a somewhat kindred spirit to that, to Sasha's piece, because in fact those two pieces stick out. I actually have not read them all, I admit, but those two pieces stick out in my mind as two attempts to earnestly simply try to embed your consciousness in the Chinese space and just talk about it without, you know, making fun of it or laughing or anything, or making you the point of it. I mean, those two pieces are, I think, really succeed in that. And
I mean, I knocked out my piece sort of week before it went to press, because as we put the collection together, we were looking for threads that tied it together. We came up with this phrase, "While we're here," which we felt would resonate with some readers. You know, we're not trying to make a statement about it. We know that some lifers, perhaps yourself included, would feel that you can belong here. Our publisher Graham Earnshaw certainly feels that way. That you know, he's not here temporarily, but for a lot of the foreigners in the collection, these are the questions we live with day to day in this place, which for however long is our home. You know, we might be here 2 years, we might be here 20 years. While we're here, it's home. And the question is, how can it feel like home? Do we belong here? I don't think you need to pull a kitto to explore these things.
Let us not pull a kitto. So I think we should hear something from this. Maybe if we would maybe read a couple of extracts from stories. I'm fascinated by this dumpling story you were just talking about. Maybe there's an appropriate passage, Tom, that you could read from that, which you've already set up, so I think people understand the story.
Sure. So there's two characters in this story, Gary and Charlie. Gary is kind of the fresh off the boat foreigner. Charlie is the one who's been around a while. And they, I won't read from the beginning, but they leave Charlie's apartment and they're walking down toward the dumpling restaurant, talking And what I think you're kind of in Gary's head, seeing the sights and sounds of China, and I think it really kind of speaks to the kind of excitement that people have when they first arrive here. The area was neither rich nor poor, Gary thought. He kept recording details, the rare signs of movement and life, while Charlie walked a stride or two ahead, quiet and straight. After 15 minutes walking, they emerged on a main road. Here, suddenly, people conglomerated and burst across roads without traffic lights. Taxis dropped off and picked up. The pavement had small areas for sport, exercise, and outdoor seating. The air smelled fresh and damp as if water was nearby. Some low canal going green with weeds and algae. Most importantly of all, hundreds of places to eat. By far, the majority of the shops were restaurants or window stalls for takeaway. Gary and Charlie turned left and brushed by the entrances, waiters running in and out, and they could see food on tables, bright dishes, rice bowls, teapots in more expensive places, metal cylinders full of wooden chopsticks and the cheap, ones, yellow-walled, crowded, paper table coverings, dirt on the floor, meat on racks, cigarettes steaming, kitchens open, the walls adorned with calligraphy and pictures of farm animals, and menus all in Chinese characters. Each restaurant seemed in the middle of a celebration. Gary asked his cousin why he hadn't brought him here before. He didn't get a clear answer. "You see that place with the Jiaozi sign?" Charlie shouted over the noise. "That's where we should go." "What sign? Where?" "The red one, that one." Inside, the restaurant was cloudy with condensation. Wet ceiling and walls trickling down, being mopped up by paper towels all along the windowsill. Each dish was served too hot to touch and still soaked with steamer water, burst out with mist every time one of the couples or family groups who surrounded them picked up a dumpling and bit into it, panting from the temperature and then laughing together. Gary smiled at this too, looking at the wall displays of immaculately photographed dumplings, trying to spin his chopsticks on his fingers, holding up and sniffing the vinegar bottles. Charlie looked uncertain, awkward in this new, different environment. When the waiter approached, he spoke with the fewest words possible. "This is what I want." Gary insisted they try a whole bunch of different kinds, even though Charlie thought three gin was way too much food. It would be a bad idea. "If I could speak Chinese like that, I'd do it all the time," Gary thought. "Ask how's life? How's business? What was the point of this reluctance to fit in, this refusal to enjoy being in China?" "Hey, see what I got?" Gary said as they waited. He took out a tiny plastic container from his jacket pocket, a Chinese chessboard. It was a travel set with creased plastic sheet, which had a grid lightly printed on the top. "Cool, huh? I bought it last weekend, and it was only 3 kuai. Playing it back in the apartment is fine, but we should come out here and play outside like the Chinese do." Charlie looked doubtful. "Come on, you don't want a rematch before the food arrives. I'll give you a decent game this time." No, that's okay." "Why not?" His cousin shifted in his seat on the other side of the table. "It just seems like, I don't know, drawing attention. There may not be time anyway." "What's the worst that could happen?" Gary asked, annoyed suddenly. People will see it as some kind of statement. I don't know. I'm not trying to say, so someone will come over and speak to us? Is that what you're afraid of? Mate, we live here." "Speak to us?" Both of their tones had quickly changed. "They're not going to speak to you, are they? They're going to speak to me." "Oh, for fuck's sake, fine," Gary said. And he put the set away, and then they stopped and left it on the side of the table, unopened but visible through its clouded plastic case. The food arrived, and the waiter put three bowls piled with dumplings down in the middle, the potential playing area gone.
Wow, that was really good. The description, the street description was astonishingly good. Yeah. Wow, I really look forward to that, and much else in this collection.
Which we should also plug for poetry, I think, just very quickly. Anthony Tao is poetry editor of the Ant Hill, and
that's right.
Great pieces of doggerel in there, including a Christmas poem by Kaiser.
This show is actually probably going to come out around Christmas, so maybe it would be appropriate if I read. It's short. It's a silly little piece of doggerel.
The way... doggerel is not a pejorative term.
It is.
No, it's not.
Oh, it's got to be.
It is.
No, I mean, is the word limerick a pejorative term?
No. Well, but I mean, but it's still, it's silly. It's light. It's this is called Old Choky Christmas, Festive Doggerel by me. In winter's all still, and the sun's scanty rays filter downward in pewter and silvery grays, I find myself strolling down memory hutong to Beijing in winters when life was more putong. Glazed roof tiles girded in glistening icicles, sonorous bells on still plentiful bicycles, cabbages, coal smoke, and good shuiyang ro, and sidewalks all covered in soot-blackened snow. The winters seemed colder and Hohai would freeze while the snow would collect on the boughs of the trees. It's rare now to see cabbage stacked on the stoop, which by springtime would rot to gelatinous goop. The tempting aromas of sugar-fried lidzi, and yams baked in oil drums wafts to your beads, or sweet, crunchy skewers of red candied haw, which are no longer sold come the early spring thaw. No Christmas-time feasts back then, nothing so grand. We MacGyvered it up with the scraps we'd at hand. Instead of the turkey, and after ate brandy, we guzzled Yanjing and ate white rabbit candy. It may be the earth has been globally warmed. It may be my memory by time's been transformed. But winter these days doesn't feel so romantic as the pace of life toggles twixt hectic and frantic. Modernity offers its own winter charms, though I'm not sure it helps more than it harms. Both April Gourmet and, of course, Jenny Lou's offer comfort food cures for the grim winter blues. And with broadband these days, the chill might not trouble you, even considering the damn GFW. Though internet blockages make us quite bitter, we still manage access to Facebook and Twitter. The web offers so many ways to enjoy all those holiday classics I loved as a boy. I sit by my space heater, warm in my chokku, and stream It's a Wonderful Life off of Yoku. We send SMS to spread holiday cheer and nativity missives, at least half sincere, and Hanukkah greetings as well if you choose, since half of the gringos in Beijing are Jews. The net has made giving of gifts all too easy, from Zhengban to Shanzhai, from tawdry to cheesy, and what could beat Taobao for buying your presents to have them delivered by tricycling peasants? The traffic gets bad, but it's bad in each season. To get me across town, you'll need a good reason. I normally don't mind the subway at all, at least in the spring or the summer or fall, but with everyone wearing a fluffy down jacket, each subway car needs extra staff just to pack it. They shove you inside just as hard as they can, like they do for the rush hour trains in Japan. Come winter, the nightlife does not drop a beat. The revelers give off enough body heat. The bars are decked out in the Christmas decor, meaning lights they've left up since the season before. Hot toddies and mulled wine and eggnog with rum, though prices, I fear, are princely ass sum. With globalization, wherever you roam, the holidays won't be too different from home. But I wonder if that's what it should be about. With each passing winter comes reason to doubt. So for Christmas this year, I'm inclined more than not to dine with a family on mutton hot pot. As for wintertime goodies completely indigenous, is goose all that better than fine roasted pigeon is? An old choky Christmas. Now, what could be finer than spending the holidays right here in China? It's the small things, they say, that make life worth the living. Intentions, not price tags, make gifts worth the giving. Those home comforts can't match the fresh candied haws or the chestnuts or yams. Suck on that, Santa Claus.
Oh, there are tears in my eyes.
Okay, that's probably the worst thing I've ever written. But it was
cheeky scansion.
I have to. Brendan O'Kane dropped a couple of those, and actually, gelatinous goop actually came from you, David.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I have to claim credit.
Yeah, you do. You
gelatinous
do.
Goop fame.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but luckily this is on the podcast because the only 4,563 people who can appreciate that probably will get to hear it now.
Yeah. Great. That's so it comes out November 27th and it'll be available on Amazon. It's called While We Were Here.
China Stories from a Writer's Colony.
China Stories from a Writer's Colony. And check out the Ant Hill.
.org.
Anthill.org. And it's
And contribute.
And contribute, yes. Absolutely. There are many writers among our listeners. Yeah. I mean, I get lots of great letters from people all the time, and I suspect that you have some.
We hope to do some more events too. We did a couple of events. We talked a little about 1920s Paris and all of the booze we've done.
We've done
two events. One was called Writers and Rum, which was in Suzhou Bar, which is a great bar in the Hudong.
Yeah.
And the other was called Scotch and Stories at the Bookworm. So I guess we're running out of puns.
Right, and you put me toward the end, and I was already completely. Yeah.
Tequila and Tales.
Yeah,
that should be coming out in February.
Done.
Gin and journalism.
Brandy and books.
Okay, but thanks, guys. That was wonderful. You'll stick around and make recommendations with us, I hope.
Sure.
Okay, yeah. Well, we start with you, Alec.
I have a two-part recommendation, but they're both recommendations about walking. Beijing is a great walking city, even in winter, especially in winter. The first is a book, which is one of my all-time favorite Beijing books, which I don't believe has been recommended on the podcast before. It's called The Search for a Vanishing Beijing.
Oh, yes. Wow.
That's great.
Do you know this one?
By Aldrich.
M.A. Aldrich from 2008. Yes. So he was a lawyer in Beijing. Yeah. I don't know if he's still a about, but he certainly lived here for 15 years.
This came out
7 years ago, 2008, but he was a long-time resident. And what he's done, he's fused fascinating history of Beijing with some suggested walks. So you can walk through the Gulao area and he'll tell you, you know, for example, you know, the drum tower is 99 feet high because spirits were meant to cruise at 100 feet to avoid it. And you can follow his footsteps around these walks and get a sense of old Beijing, if it gives from all of the honking on concrete. And the second related recommendation is an app. It's called a Voice Map. You can download it on iPhone and presumably Android. One of the people who runs it, Ian Manley, was a Shanghai guy, now based in South Africa. And they're walking guided tours. So you plug in, it hooks up to your GPS, and it speaks in your ear while you're walking, and you can follow yourself on the map. And there's a couple of routes around Beijing. One by myself, I did a...
I was going to have you recommend that, but I didn't realize that's part of the app you're recommending.
It's on the app. So my walk takes about 40 minutes. It's from the drum tower to Yonghe Gong Lama Temple, so through some of my favorite hutongs, which is also the subject I wrote about in my piece in the anthology. And the second walk from Beijing is by Paul French, and you follow like Pamela's footsteps from his book Midnight in Peking.
And yeah, see the related podcast,
right? And I think there's one from Shanghai as well, and it's good fun. One caveat to readers is that in China, the GPS is just fucked, so you have to download the route, then switch off Wi-Fi and data on your phone, then open the map in offline mode.
Really?
Because on my map, it takes readers walking over Hohai, like I'm some sort of
what
Pied
map
Piper.
Are you using?
I think it's just all GPS.
All
in
GPS
China
is a little squirrely.
Actually, no,
the actual location is not where you think it is.
I won't make a plug. Tom, what do you have for us?
So I have a book recommendation, a non-China book recommendation, which is one that I just finished that was recommended by my lovely girlfriend, called Dispatches from Pluto, and the writer's name is Richard Grant. Pluto is the name of a town in Mississippi. So the conceit is this is an English writer who was living in New York, who's in his kind of late 40s, writing for magazines and kind of travel writing and things like that. He took a trip down to the Mississippi Delta, like very deep south Mississippi, and to visit some friends and fell in love with a house, like an old plantation house. Out in the middle of nowhere in a place in a town called Pluto, population like 30 or something like that. He buys the house and he and his girlfriend move down there. And it's the book kind of traces their year plus living in this very remote part of Mississippi. So a lot of stuff on food and music, a lot of race relations, wildlife, hunting. It's very funny. It's a very funny book.
So it's almost very Bill Bryson-y in a way.
It is, yeah. I mean, and it's very, but it's very sympathetic to things, to, you know, to the people in the South. I mean, you know, Mississippi has got a lot of, you know, social ills and problems, but he's very sympathetic to the people. It's a really great read, and it's always nice. I'm American. It's always nice being kind of reminded of how incredibly exotic my own country is to some places after everything seeming so normal in China. It's kind of reading about, you know, the Deep South and Mississippi is just like seems like an entirely different world.
It's a great recommendation, Tom. Yeah. Dispatches from Pluto by
Richard Grant.
Richard Grant, excellent. David, what do you have for us?
Just real quickly. Nice series, video series online that was indirectly recommended to me by Victor Mayer, but I discovered it. It's called, in Chinese, it's called Luoji Siwei.
Yeah,
logical thinking. And the host is this wonderful guy named Luo Zhenyu. Very engaging, very funny. He basically, it's basically whatever he wants to talk about, but it's mostly Chinese history, comparative history, East and West differences. You know, issues of politics, issues of the DNA of Chinese culture, of Han Xue, of Confucianism, whatever he wants to talk about.
Where's he based?
In China. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this is broadcast or if it's only an online. It's on YouTube, which is where I downloaded from. But it's great for people who just want to kind of beef up their Chinese listening because the subtitles, there's, you know, Chinese subtitles. And a lot of it goes over my head, and I look at the subtitles, and I've got it. The main thing is this guy, Luo Zhengyu, is a very fluent, wonderful speaker, looks right into the camera and just blabs away.
Wow,
in
that
fluent
great.
And beautiful
what
Chinese.
A great recommendation.
Yeah, and it's fun to listen to, and you learn a lot, and he's just a great guy.
How do we find it? It's just we just look
Google,
up Luo Zhengyu.
Go on YouTube and look up Luo Zhengyu. Yeah.
Okay, wow.
Or on just probably on Youku too.
Well, terrific. I have just one quick recommendation, and it's in anticipation for a show that we'll be taping hopefully in early December with Christina Larson, who has just been really killing it writing on all sorts of science topics. In Scientific American, on November 17th, she published a great piece called China's Bold Push into Genetically Customized Animals. It's interesting, but it looks at the CRISPR, CA9 technology. CRISPR, if you haven't heard of it, CRISPR, usually written in all caps, is essentially a gene editing technology that was developed really very recently, only 2013. I think it's going to be one of the most transformative technologies of our time. This basically uses the immune system of prokaryotic cells. They developed a system where they can very easily use an enzyme knife to basically cut out very specific pieces. You can tell this CRISPR system to go in and cut out a particular gene, float some genetic material you want substituted for it in the general vicinity, and it'll insert, and astonishingly it will pass on that new genetic code to future generations. So every nightmare you've ever had and every fantasy you've ever had about whether it's Hitlerian Ubermensch or super soldiers
creating a race of giant Superman or whatever. Right?
But also solving hunger it's amazing. And
I'm pretty sure it was a Radiolab episode on.
That's right. That's where I first heard of it, from Radiolab. And I've been fascinated by the technology ever since. So Christina is going to come and talk about work that's being done using CRISPR here in China, where the bioethics are slightly different. She's written a very good piece. Please read it ahead of the podcast.
Yeah, and for Seneca listeners, you can get 3 hours of college credit biology if you listen to the podcast.
Thanks, guys.
Given by Kaiser.
Alakash, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, man.
I really look forward to reading the rest of the anthology. Tom Pelham, thanks very much for coming on. And it was great having you. And thanks for that reading of this terrific short story.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
David, man, we'll see you next week. And happy Thanksgiving. You'll hear this late to all our American listeners. We'll see you next week on Seneca Podcast.